This is Wendy Bauer, returning with the December 7th, 2015 edition of the Decatur Herald and Review. We continue now with the death notices on page A6. Anne Shellabarger Abbott. Anne Shellabarger Abbott, age 89, of LaPorte, Indiana, passed away Thursday, December 3rd, 2015, at Miller's Merry Manor in LaPorte. A Celebration of Life memorial service will be held at 12 o'clock noon Saturday, December 12, 2015, at the Cutler Funeral Home and Cremation Center, 2900 Monroe Street, LaPorte. A visitation will be held on Saturday from 10 a.m. until the time of service at the funeral home. A cremation committal has taken place with the Cutler Funeral Home and Cremation Center. A private family burial will be held Saturday at the Pine Lake Cemetery in LaPorte. Memorial contributions may be made to the Alzheimer's Association, 50 East 91st Street, Suite 100, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46209-4830, or the Presbyterian Church of LaPorte, 307 Kingsbury Avenue, LaPorte, Indiana, 46350. Robert Wayne Arnold, Cerro Gordo. Robert Wayne Fuzzy Diesel Arnold, 72, of Candler, North Carolina, formerly of Cerro Gordo, Illinois, and Oakland City, Indiana, passed away Tuesday, December 1st, 2015, in his home. A memorial service will be held in Cerro Gordo, Illinois, at a later date. Jeffrey R. Long, Decatur. Jeffrey R. Long, 44, of Decatur, Illinois, passed away at 5 o'clock p.m. Friday, December 4th, 2015, in Barnes Jewish Hospital, St. Louis, Missouri. Funeral services will be held at 1 o'clock p.m. Wednesday, December 9th, at First Christian Church, Decatur. Visitation will be from 5 to 8 o'clock p.m. Tuesday, December 8th, at Brintlinger and Earl Funeral Home, Decatur. Burial will be in North Fork Cemetery, Decatur. Memorials may be made to First Christian Church. David Lauren Bartholomew Arthur. David Lauren Bartholomew, 60, of Arthur, died at 1:04 a.m. Friday, December 4, 2015, at Barnes Jewish Hospital in St. Louis, Missouri. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, December 10, 2015, at the Arthur United Methodist Church, 128 East Illinois Street. Graveside services will follow at 2 o'clock p.m. at the Washington Street Cemetery in Casey. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday at the Schrader Funeral Home, 431 South Vine Street, Arthur. Masonic rites will be conducted following the visitation. Memorials are suggested to Barnes Jewish Hospital, St. Louis, Missouri, Arthur United Methodist Church, or the Arthur Masonic Lodge. Robert Eugene Wade, Mount Zion. Robert Eugene Wade, 76, of Mount Zion, Illinois, passed away Saturday, December 5, 2015, in St. Mary's Hospital, surrounded by family and loved ones. The family will be hosting a memorial gathering at 11 a.m. Tuesday, December 8, 2015, at Central Baptist Church, 945 South Jasper Street, Decatur. Lola Lauer, Moequa. Lola Lauer, 93, of Moequa, formerly of Pena, Illinois, passed away December 5, 2015, in her home. Private family services will be held at Site's Funeral Home in Moequa. Burial will be in Glenwood Cemetery, Shelbyville, Illinois. Memorials may be made to Humane Society of Decatur and Macon County. And finally, a list of the funerals pending for Monday, December 7th, 2015 include John D. Gifford, 81, of Decatur, who died December 6th, Tanzius Logan Funeral Services and Care. Barbara Hardy, 92, Decatur, died Saturday, December 5th, 2015, Moran and Goebel Funeral Home. Donald H. Schull, 65, Decatur, died Saturday, December 5th, 2015, Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Richard L. Storm, 83, of Arthur, died Saturday, December 5th, 2015, Edwards Funeral Home, Arcola. And now an article from the local pages, Celebrating the Season, subtitled Making Cards for Soldiers, Part of Charleston Event. The article begins with a splendid picture taken at dusk of a white carriage drawn by a white horse. The caption is, a horse-drawn carriage makes its way along the parade route during the Christmas in the Heart of Charleston event. This article is written by Jared Jarman, Lee News Service writer from Charleston. While it's numerous days before Christmas, many in the community joined in a years-long tradition of celebrating the holiday season, along with traditions that follow suit Saturday night on the Charleston Square for Christmas in the Heart of Charleston. Along with the eating of chestnuts, roasted over an open fire, and the winter chill nipping at people's noses, people were also able to write Christmas cards for servicemen and servicewomen and veterans. Normally a place of dance, the Dance Life Center, for the night, changed into a home of arts and crafts for families to make and create cards that will be sent to these servicemen and servicewomen. With the help of Girl Scouts of America, people had the opportunity to write out Christmas cards showing support to those who may not be able to come home for Christmas. Trish Briggerman, Girl Scouts Membership Development Manager of Southern Illinois, said the idea to have this added endeavor sprouted from previous projects run by Girl Scouts. Around this time of year, Girl Scouts have an Adopt-a-Soldier program as well as facilitate the ability for community members to buy a box of cookies to be sent to soldiers. Briggerman said they thought they could facilitate something similar to these programs as part of Charleston's holiday traditions. Writing these cards shows them that they are appreciated and that they are thought of, Briggerman said. Both young and old wrote out cards offering their thanks to those in the service for what they do. One child, Case Easton, wrote, "Thank you for your service," in his card, as well as drawing a house with two people. They need encouragement just like anybody else, and this would be a good time to do it, Kelly Easton said. Writing out Christmas cards for soldiers falls in line with what Christmas in the Heart of Charleston is geared toward, Easton said. It is all about celebrating a season with your family and the troops, whether they are at service or in a hospital recuperating somewhere. They still need the Christmas spirit, she added. They still need to be supported. And trending 1 hour ago, early morning, December 7th, from Dixon Springs, prison officials say two inmates escape in Southern Illinois. State prison officials say two inmates incarcerated on drug charges have escaped a facility in Southern Illinois. A statement from an Illinois Department of Corrections spokeswoman says staff at the Dixon Springs Impact Incarceration Program noticed 25-year-old Jarrett Reed and 20-year-old Kevin Rivera missing at 5:50 p.m. Sunday. Reed is serving a 3-year sentence on meth-related charges out of Randolph County. Rivera is serving a 5-year sentence for the manufacture and delivery of cocaine out of Cook County. Authorities are searching for the men who were last seen wearing orange t-shirts and blue pants. Residents were advised to use caution and contact authorities if they notice suspicious activity. The facility from which they escaped is located near the Kentucky border in Pope County. Article titled Meridian Excited for New School Buildings, written by Valerie Wells, a staff writer for the Herald and Review, comes out of Macon. The performing arts students at Meridian High School will have the best facilities their district could give them by the time they come back from winter break. Workers are putting the finishing touches on a state-of-the-art auditorium which boasts built-in lights and professional sound, dressing rooms, soundproofing, and the ability to shoot video. The football field is finished and softball field is almost done. The track is laid and the soccer field is sodded. The baseball field is under construction. Inside, tables that fold up and chairs with wheels make it easy for students and teachers to shuffle furnishings to suit whatever activity is underway. Every student has a Chromebook and the building is wireless throughout, with plans to do the same with the middle school students in January. District staff will move the school over the Christmas break. It will be like a college campus, Superintendent Dan Brew said. They have study hall the last period of the day, and they're out there using the furniture, using the Chromebooks. It's fun to watch, actually. The one-to-one technology has helped increase communication between students and teachers, he said, because it's easier for them to send email to each other and send assignments back and forth. The auditorium will be christened December 22nd with a talent and variety show right before the winter break. The band room and the choir room are adjacent to the auditorium, and both of these rooms are soundproof, including the doors. They can be in there playing and you can't even hear them, said Erica Dowd, the chorus teacher. Students helped set up and organize art teacher Laura Klink's classroom, which boasts big windows and lots of natural light, at her request. The architects asked me for suggestions and actually used some of my ideas, said Klink, who is thrilled to have adequate storage, room to display student art, and dedicated closet for the kiln, which will soon be hooked up. The chorus and band rooms feature the ability to record rehearsals, and this is the first time the chorus has had a room set up just for them, Brew said. The risers and chairs can be left in place, and the soundproofing will keep their voices from echoing and distorting as they did in their previous practice area in the old gym. The library will be shared by middle and high school students, and the computer lab features 50 devices with larger screens at each table and the front of the room that can display any computer's screen for collaboration. The gym in the former high school section is serving as storage at present. The district held 3 auctions through the summer to dispose of items no longer needed, and in the process of cleaning out and remodeling, found a few treasures, too. We found a vintage Coke machine that still works, Brew said. We sold it for $4,000. The 1% sales tax increase voters approved countywide in 2010 allowed the district to make the upgrades, which Brew said should serve the district for at least 50 years. The design is deliberately flexible for that reason. In the main corridor of the building, where students pass through to get to classes and which serves as the eating area, a sign hangs from the crosswalk above. We are Meridian. In an article out of Bloomington, Bloomington couple saved by carbon monoxide alarm. This is written by Kevin Barlow, the Lee News Service writer. Begins with a photograph of Doug and Mary Lee Matthews of Bloomington standing in a hallway next to the carbon monoxide detector that alerted them to a dangerous level of the gas while they were sleeping in November. At first, Doug Matthews didn't want to pay attention to the alarm that started sending an alert at 1:05 a.m. on a recent Saturday morning. It is one of those with the voice, and it said the carbon monoxide levels were 131 parts per million in a quite strident tone, he said. The first thing I thought was that it needed new batteries, but I knew I had just changed the batteries about a month earlier. Knowing that levels above 70 parts per million were dangerous, he changed the batteries and set the alarm on the bedroom dresser. 5 minutes later, it went off again. So this time I knew it was the real deal. I called the fire department and the dispatcher, and the dispatcher said to get out of the house immediately and call 911, said Matthews of Bloomington. Both he and his wife, Mary Lee, felt fine and didn't have any of the symptoms of carbon monoxide poisoning, but fire officials finished the investigation and told them they'd made a wise decision. Further investigation revealed the levels to be more than 500 parts per million in the basement. The problem was traced to a faulty heater on a spa. Last week, the Normal Fire Department responded to two separate medical calls involving illness and fainting due to carbon monoxide issues that became more pronounced with the onset of cold weather, and leading the department to urge homeowners to check that their alarms are working properly and to install an alarm if one is not already in the home. We really feel like we dodged a bullet twice, but we may not be as lucky the next time, said Fire Chief Mick Humer. Carbon monoxide is a colorless, odorless, and tasteless gas byproduct of burning fossil fuels. At elevated levels, it causes sickness and, if not detected, death. Your body can't see or smell carbon monoxide, so it has earned the nickname the Silent Killer, said Normal Fire Department Public Information Officer Matt Swaney. If carbon monoxide levels are high enough, you may go to sleep and never wake up. Last month, the Bloomington Fire Department also responded to a home with extremely high levels of carbon monoxide. They were outside their home complaining of headaches, said Stuart Blade, the agency's public information officer. The son woke up in the morning, was able to walk to his parents' bedroom, complaining of a headache. All family members had symptoms of carbon monoxide poisoning. The first responding unit arrived to find readings of more than 100 parts per million in the garage and as high as 550 parts per million in the basement. The family went to the hospital for precautionary measures and the residence was cleared of carbon monoxide. A faulty heater was found to be the cause. Fossil fuels, such as natural gas, are used to heat the vast majority of American homes, and faulty heating equipment accounts for nearly one-third of accidental monoxide deaths, said fire officials. These can include home heating systems, improperly vented gas appliances, kerosene or propane space heaters, charcoal grills, and sterno-type fluids. The health effects of carbon monoxide poisoning depend on the concentration and length of exposure, as well as each individual's health condition. Most people will not experience any symptoms from prolonged exposure to carbon monoxide levels of 1 to 70 parts per million, but some heart patients might experience an increase in chest pain. As carbon monoxide levels increase and remain among 70 parts per million, symptoms become more noticeable and can include headache, fatigue, and nausea. At sustained carbon monoxide concentrations above 150 to 220 parts per million, disorientation, unconsciousness, and death are possible, according to the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission. And the sidebar to this article, poisoning symptoms. Symptoms of carbon monoxide poisoning are similar to those of the flu and include headache, fatigue, shortness of breath, nausea, and dizziness. Other signs of possible carbon monoxide presence include condensation on walls and windows, house plants dying, house pets becoming sluggish, and chronic odors from malfunctioning appliances. If you suspect you may be experiencing carbon monoxide poisoning, go outside immediately and call 911. And Donette Beckett, Herald and Review staff writer, brings an article, Christmas Extravaganza, St. Mary's Auxiliary Craft Sale to be held December 8th. From Decatur, George Auten has worked with lumber for almost 70 years. It's in my blood, I guess, he said. He retired from a local lumberyard 25 years ago, but still uses wood to craft items such as cutting boards and pencil and jewelry holders. He is among the craft makers who will have products for sale at the HSHS St. Mary's Auxiliary Christmas Extravaganza from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. Tuesday, December 8th in the hospital's Assisi Room. The majority of the craft items were made by members of the St. Mary's Auxiliary Volunteers. These ladies buy their own material and work every Monday as part of the auxiliary, said our organizer Susan Dudra. The things they create are all made by hand and donated to us. Approximately 10 vendors will be displayed along with a separate section for crafts and one for baked goods. Vendors include specialty businesses such as Petals and the Pampered Chef. The baked goods are all donated to the event. We will have cookies, cakes, pies, said organizer Anita Culp. We even have sugar-free things and gluten-free things, too, Deudra said. Two raffles also are planned. One featured item this year is a handmade queen-sized quilt. Throughout the year, four women donated their time and material to create the white quilt. It is all completely hand-stitched, Deudra said. The auxiliary is an important part of the hospital's daily routines. The ladies wearing their pink smocks and the men in blue can be seen in the halls, the gift shop, and pushing wheelchairs. Carol Bork is an auxiliary member who has experience throughout the hospital. I started in other departments of the hospital, transporting gift shop, she said. Now she is one of the women painting, sewing, and finishing many of the craft items. The group has been so busy this year crafting that they have had to store their finished items in various locations throughout the hospital. The hospital directors have also come to rely on the auxiliary for other support. The directors have a wish list that they would like for their departments that aren't in their budget, Deudra said. Proceeds from the Christmas extravaganza will go toward inpatient behavior health televised programs. We have a lot of people who are super people who just want to give their time, Deudra said, and we reap the benefit. Auten has been donating his time and his projects for 3 years to the auxiliary. Although he is happy to be able to help, he also enjoys the work. People ask me if I will make something, Auten said. I tell them no. I gave up having pressure. And the sidebar says, if you go, the St. Mary's Hospital Auxiliary Christmas Extravaganza Craft Show and Sale will be from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Tuesday, December 8th at the Hospital Assisi Room in the Forum. The admission is free. And Teresa Churchill, senior writer from Herald and Review, writing Operation Sleigh Bell, A Helping Hand at Christmas. From Decatur. Operation Sleigh Bell, a low-cost Christmas shopping opportunity available every December since 2005, returns to Decatur next week, but with a twist. Walk-ins will be accepted starting Wednesday afternoon to cut down on the amount organizers must pack back up for the next year. The experiment is a result of a couple phenomena, according to Reverend Steve Cecil, pastor of Westside Church of the Nazarene. The good news is that donors to the ministry have been especially generous this year. The bad news is the number of people who made shopping appointments last month is the lowest in recent memory. The Reverend Rick Smith, who founded Operation Sleigh Bell in Champaign in 1982, blamed a reduction in the number of telephone lines and a switch to a new telephone number for making appointments. Cecil said the Decatur site also saw an increase in 2014 in the number of people who did not show up for their shopping appointments, another reason to give the concept of a walk-in a try. Last year we had the kind of excellent toys and clothing left on Wednesday morning that we normally run out of on Monday afternoon, Cecil said. We kept hearing that our customers didn't have their checks yet. Participants are asked to pay $1 for most gifts for a maximum of three for each member of the household. Next week, however, Decatur shoppers will also be able to purchase bonus gifts that don't count toward the total, and Cecil said there will be many more buy multiple items for a dollar options. We're trying every way we can think of to be extra generous this year, he said. Smith said he likely will open Champaign's Operation Sleigh Bell to walk-in shoppers, but is leaving the decision up to each site supervisor. Operation Sleigh Bell is offered in Neoga, Danville, and Peoria, in addition to Decatur and Champaign. I expect to see us help 100 to 200 more families than we did last year, Smith said. The dollar giving was up this year. We did well as far as product donations, and everything just seemed to fall into place. Something else will change about Operation Sleigh Bell for 2016, according to Smith and Cecil, who say they understand they will have to find a new Decatur location after operating next week out of the former Schnucks grocery store for the 11th consecutive year. And the sidebar says, if you go, it's Operation Sleigh Bell in Decatur. Walk-in shoppers will be accepted from 12:30 to 3 p.m. on Wednesday, December 9th, and from 9 a.m. to noon on Thursday, December 10th. Public shopping will begin at noon Thursday, December 10th. Location is the former Schnucks Grocery Store, 2800 North Water Street. An article out of Bloomington, Clinton sex offender to be resentenced. A Clinton man serving life in prison for sexually abusing three children will be returned to McLean County for a new sentencing hearing after a ruling by the 4th District Appellate Court. Brett M. Wilson, now 22, was sentenced in April 2013 for four counts of predatory criminal sexual assault. In its ruling, the appellate court said that life in prison was not appropriate because Wilson was younger than 18 when three of the assaults occurred. The life terms imposed by Judge Scott Drzewski on two of the counts violate the constitutional prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment, according to the ruling. Wilson's new sentence could amount to a life term. He is eligible for 6 to 60 years, which must be served consecutively on each of the four counts. The state offered two other appellate cases in favor of the life sentence, but neither involved circumstances identical to the Wilson case. Under Illinois law, a life sentence is mandatory for a person convicted of predatory sexual assault of two or more children, regardless of whether the offenses stem from one act or several acts. The conflict in the Wilson case stems from the defendant's age when the abuse took place. Citing a U.S. Supreme Court case, the appellate court noted the Eighth Amendment prohibits states from making the judgment at the outset that juvenile offenders of non-homicide crimes never will be fit to reenter society. The appellate court rejected defense arguments that Drzewski erred in two of his rulings. The judge was correct in his handling of testimony from witnesses about other crimes allegedly committed by Wilson, said the court. The judge also was correct in his decision to bar the jury from seeing a videotape the defense asked to use. First Assistant State's Attorney Adam Grist did not improperly act as a human lie detector during closing arguments, the appellate court ruled. Statements that urged jurors to carefully consider Wilson's mannerisms during police interviews did not represent the prosecutor's personal opinions, according to the ruling. The prosecutor did not weigh the credibility of the witnesses, which is the jury's exclusive province, but asked the jury to do so by what it observed, said the ruling. The victims were younger than 10 at the time of assaults and were acquainted with Wilson. The incidents were reported to authorities in January 2012. Wilson denied the allegations. During his trial, he claimed adults close to the children manipulated the youngsters into saying the assaults took place. And this has been Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review on December 7th, 2015. I look forward to reading with you again soon. Thank you.